Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Best-selling author Michael Lewis says we're in a dark age of fatherhood. Dad's no longer allowed to be happily clueless. The modern father expected to really pitch in. But if expectations are high, he says, they're also unclear. And a lot of the fundamentals, he says, unconditional love, basic parenting competence, don't come as easily as they're supposed to. So has he nailed it, or is he copping out? This hour, On Point, Michael Lewis on being a dad now. You can join the conversation. Fathers, do you feel like the rules are out the window and you're making it up? Moms, do you just want him to change the diapers and deal with it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Michael Lewis joins us now from Seattle. He's a best-selling author, well-known for his hugely popular books on sports and finance, Moneyball, Liar's Poker, The Blind Side. He's also a father of three, two girls and a boy. His new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. Michael Lewis, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here you were, writing, working, living, and on the side, or in the middle, depending how you look, having three kids and writing about that, I think, for Slate. And you've kind of woven those columns into this book. Have I got it right?
Almost. I wove first a journal into Slate columns.
Okay.
I mean, the way this all started was, I don't know, 4 or 5 months after the birth of our first child, which is now 10 years ago, I was just really struck by the gap between what I was experiencing as a new father and what the world had led me to believe it was like. And I just started to try to describe the experience to myself in the journal, just to make sense of it in a journal. And I started giving it to my wife because she regarded me as something of a black box. She didn't understand why I was behaving the way I was behaving, and it made her feel better to have these explanations. And then I started publishing some of these things.
Yeah.
Really, it was about the period after the birth of each of our three children, the first year or so, that fog of wartime,
right.
In Slate. Never really thought I was going to bring it out as a book, but it got all, oddly, a friend of mine printed it all out and sent it to me, and I started to read through it, and I thought, there's a narrative here. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of an evolution of the soul of a father. That because I was writing about the experience in real time, and at first really just to myself, it was a raw, unvarnished kind of quality to it in the beginning, and that it captured sort of feelings I had in the moment that I had entirely forgotten, and in some ways had gotten over. But seemed sort of worth airing because I had never read it before.
It's really about the very the young years of your three children. You have two daughters, Quinn and Dixie, and one son, the third child, Walker. Some people may know or remember your wife, Tabitha Soren, who was a reporter on MTV back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that when you got into this, you say, when I became a father, I really had only one role model, my own father. He bequeathed to me an attitude to the job, but the job had changed. What was the attitude? Well, give us a sense of what you received and then what you were expected to deliver.
Let me preface this by saying I have a deep and rich and very happy relationship with my own father, but he didn't lift a finger for the first, 14 years of my life. I mean, he participated a bit in the fun parts, but he was very much a dad of the previous generation. My mother did all the work.
You quote him saying, I didn't even talk to you until you went away to college.
He
a little exaggeration, but still.
No, he watched me perplexed, trying to wrestling with an infant and putting her in a diaper or changing her. And he said, "You know, I didn't even talk to you till you were 21 years old. What are you doing?" There is no way I could look to my father as a model for what was expected of me. So the role of the mother and father roles had changed obviously dramatically since he had gone through it, and now there were these new roles. And what was striking to me is that while my father operated with a standard, he could go about his life kind of as a father, kind of unthinkingly, because every other father around him was doing things basically the same way. This standard, you know, and I don't have any particular affection for that standard. I wouldn't defend that standard. Mm. But once you don't have it, the level of confusion and anxiety it creates is astonishing.
You describe that attitude as sort of detached amusement. That no longer allowed.
That doesn't pass. You don't get a passing grade for that anymore. And I'm distraught. Look, I live in Berkeley, California, which is supposedly, which is sort of a reservoir of new fathering attitudes and talents. But nevertheless, within blocks of me, I can find people who fathers who have kids roughly the same age who regard me as a Neanderthal because I don't do even more than I do. And then I can find other fathers who think I'm sort of the thoroughly modern dad and marvel at how involved I am in the raising of my children. That there's such differences from house to house in how people go about this. And since there's no longer kind of a generally agreed upon standard, there's an awful lot of haggling that goes on around it. And when you land, this has to do more with domestic politics than with actually one's relationship with the children. The first thing that struck me when we had children was I was shocked by how little I felt right in the very beginning, how little attachment I felt to this creature who had come out of my wife. And I felt for quite some time that I was living in this world where I was expected to feel one way and didn't feel it. And it was really unsettling. And I think that's why I started writing this thing in the first place.
You write, you say, obviously we're in the midst of some long, unhappy transition between the model of fatherhood as practiced by my father, yours, and some ideal model approved by all to be practiced with ease by the perfect fathers of the future. I mean, I guess that's exactly what you're describing, but give us more of a sense of that transitional period you see us in.
Well, it's hard to know where we're going, right? I mean, I'm not sure there'll ever actually be a kind of agreed upon standard of behavior in what a father is meant to do, if we will take call-ins later, and I promise you, there will be someone who will call in and say, "I am a stay-at-home dad, and I'm raising my children on my own, and it is a." It's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And then there will be people who call in and say, I can't believe how much work my wife expects me to do. I'm the sole breadwinner. And it's incredibly irritating to me, just how difficult it's all become. I personally experienced this kind of range of feeling and found in the short run, anyway, especially after our first child was born, I was completely sort of befuddled by this new experience. I didn't understand the value of me seeming to participate in things where I really had no role. It was mildly interesting to me, for example, to be in the delivery room, but I was clearly in the way. And no one knew what to do with me. I'm glad I was there, but it was odd because no one really knew why I was there. And I also thought that it took me a while to appreciate this, that I was expected to do an awful lot of the work that my father had not done. And in the short term, I had trouble sort of appreciating what this was leading to, that this was leading to anything good. All it seemed to do was drain me because I was the sole breadwinner and I had all these other responsibilities. But what I found over time was And this was the payoff, was that in, you know, this is where the bonding took place.
Mm.
That it was just slower than it was in the case of my wife. But in caring for the thing, that is where the love kicked in. You sort of, in taking care of a thing, you sort of learn to love it.
In caring for the thing.
It starts out as this thing that you're responsible for keeping alive. And but in caring for it, you develop the feelings that I thought you were supposed to have right away.
You know,
but it took a while.
Yeah, I read all that and heard that. At the same time, there's this persistent sort of quiet rebellion, sub-theme of rebellion here, as if, you know, you're asking, is this really the role I'm supposed to play? I mean, I couldn't help but wonder if this is, you've gussied it up nicely, but is it in a way a back-to-nature call? You know, dad hunts the wildebeest and mom raises the kids.
You mean, is this a manifesto?
I don't know, somewhere in there, there's a little resistance.
There's absolutely plenty of resistance. Yeah. But I'll tell you that there is, what I've written is not a manifesto. It's just more of a description of the experience. Because in describing it, I understood it far better. And I don't think I have a pointed argument to make that there's one better way or worse way to be a father. I think, in fact, more broadly, if there is an argument kind of to be teased out of this narrative, it's that I think that the there are many ways to be a good father. There are many ways to do this job well. It's a lot more fault tolerant than one suspects it is when one starts out very anxiously on the journey, and it's a plea for everybody just to chill out a little bit about it all. but I, of course, when I go through this, some of this writing goes back 10 years.
Yeah.
There was no chilling out at all. It was a very fraught experience.
Of course, there can't be. You're right in the middle of it. Michael Lewis joins us today, author, of course, of Moneyball, Liar's Poker, The Blind Side, Coach. His new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. He joins us from Seattle. Listeners, you can join us. What is a good dad these days? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael Lewis, stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Liberty Mutual for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And the Museum of Science Boston, committed to promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide. More information at mos.org/NCTL.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, and on the web at WBUR.org. Coming up at noontime today, it's Here and Now. Among the stories on the show today, the World Health Organization has declared a swine flu pandemic. We'll have that story and more on Here and Now, which begins at noon here on WBUR. Our forecast says clouds today, highs around 60 degrees, showers tonight with lows in the 50s, thunderstorms tomorrow. Temperatures should be in the 70s. And right now for the weekend, it looks like it'll be partly cloudy on Saturday, temperatures in the upper 60s. On Sunday, sunshine and highs on Sunday getting into the 70s. Right now, it's 60 degrees in Boston.
WBUR supporters include Simmons School of Management, ranked one of the top entrepreneurship programs by the Princeton Review, MBA Showcase Saturday morning at 9, mba.simmons.edu. And Rialto Restaurant Harvard Square, Chef Jody Adams explores Italian market food with a cooking class and lunch this Saturday. Reservations at 617-661-5050.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling author Michael Lewis, author of Moneyball, Liar's Poker, The Blind Side, Coach, about his new book, Home Game, and about being a father when the role itself is up for grabs. You can join the conversation. What's a good dad these days? The one who's always there? The one who brings home the bacon? The one who does both? Does it all? Is that possible? Do we expect too much or too little from dads today? Is Michael Lewis right? Is there no standard anymore? Was there ever, really? And moms, are you getting what you need from the American dad? Are your kids and dads, do you know what you're supposed to do now? What does fatherhood mean? A lot of questions there. 800-423-8255, 800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Lewis, I wish you'd read a little bit. There's a funny part here where you talk about how there's a little bit of raw deal feeling in here. You say American men were sort of tricked into taking a larger, unappreciated role. There's a bit on page 42 that gives a sense of that. Could you read for us?
Sure. This should stir people up.
Yeah. No doubt.
All right. the beginning of page 42.
Yeah.
At some point in the last few decades, the American male sat down at the negotiating table with the American female and, let us be frank, got fleeced. The agreement he signed foisted all sorts of new paternal responsibilities on him, and he gave nothing of what he gave him nothing of what he might have expected in return. Not the greater love of his wife, who now is encouraged to view him as an unreliable employee. Not the special love from his child, who, no matter how many times he fed and changed and wiped and walked her, would always prefer her mother in a pinch. Not even the admiration of the body politic, who pushed him into signing the deal. Women may smile at a man pushing a baby stroller, but it is with the gentle condescension of a high officer of an army towards a village that surrendered without a fight. Men just look away in shame. And so the American father now finds himself in roughly the same position as Gorbachev after the fall of the Berlin Wall, having shocked the world by doing the decent thing and ceding power without bloodshed for the sake of principle. He is viewed mainly with disdain. The world looks at him schlepping and fetching and sagging and moaning beneath his new burdens and thinks, oh, you poor bastard.
Michael Lewis, reading from Home Game. Well,
This captures perfectly how I felt 5 months into the job. That was written 5 months after the birth of our first child.
Child one.
And I was going basically insane. and I thought, you know, and let me tell you what motivated the beginning of this thing.
Yeah.
When people ask me, even then, how I felt about this process at the very beginning, I found myself already lying about it. It was a bit like and sanitizing it and making it sweeter and more pleasant, more sentimental and more saccharine than it actually was. And I thought, that's a shame. It's a bit like you go on a trip to some fancy place abroad. You know, you go to Paris for a week, and you come home, and you get there, and you get food poisoning, and you get mugged, and people are mean to you, and it ends up being a horrible trip. And you come home, and a week later, you're telling people about your
fabulous
trip to Paris. Yeah, because you don't want to be the guy who had the awful trip to Paris. And so I just thought, get this down on paper because I know that I'm going to be lying to myself about it. Many years to come. And right, you know, if you and I were, if I had not produced this document and you and I were just we're just talking about my experience, you would get the sentimental version. But that's the unsentimental version.
With people
in other
thinking
words, the true
you poor
bastard.
You know, though, the people are going to listen to that and say, "What do you mean, you poor bastard?" They're going to say, "You cold hearted bastard, your wife, she had the baby. You're perfectly happy with her doing all the diapers. Or, you know, you've got some little percentage of the work and now you're whining, Michael."
No, absolutely. There's no question. You're absolutely right.
Let's get the callers
right. But what percentage?
Yeah.
But let's put our finger on this. Actually,
yeah.
This is very funny. The only part of this, these journals that my wife didn't see before publication, there was a sentence in the beginning where I estimated what percentage of the hard parenting that I did. And the draft that she saw said 29.5%, and she checked that. And after she checked it, I changed it to 31.5% because I actually think it's 31.5%.
It seems in the ballpark, though. In the ballpark. Let's get some callers in here from New Milford, Connecticut. Julio, you're on the air with Father Michael Lewis.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just calling to say that when to deal with the sort of the perplexing nature of the role of fatherhood that Michael was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
My response to that was just to throw myself into as many activities as I could, from changing diapers to volunteering at the elementary school to you name it. I tried to do that, and that's how I kind of dealt with that.
And how did it work out for you? Did it leave you happy being that kind of father? Were you pretending? What?
No, I don't think I was pretending. I think sort of happy with the way things have turned out so far. My kids are only 8 and 6, so they're still young, and sort of still figuring it out too, I think, to some extent.
But you're right in the middle of it. You threw yourself in full immersion. Michael, you had your share of gymboree classes and all.
Well,
the
actually,
rest.
You know, the truth is now I have total immersion too. I coach all their teams and so on and so forth. It was sort of the mystery for me, and this is the journey I take in this story. I didn't realize I was writing a story where I would actually change, but how I got from this beast who really didn't understand what his role was in all this to someone who was really involved, and it just took a while. It didn't come naturally, but I do agree that that the solution to the problem, just the practical solution, is not to detach yourself and pretend you can be a father like my father was, because you simply won't get away with it. It doesn't work anymore. The old model's broken. I think that it's probably right, is to throw yourself into it.
But there's still a probably there. It's interesting, and a little bit of pining. Just a little. Sally in Bristol, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hi, good, Sally.
Yes, I just wanted to say I'm very happy that you're discussing this topic. Michael, you're doing a great job. What I wanted to say was we have to educate society, you know. We have to educate society so that if they see men doing the so-called women's job, they would not be shamed. Because if men can do it, if men can make rockets to go to the moon or whatever, then they can definitely take care of their kids, you know? So we shouldn't shame men when they do things that are considered women's job or women's whatever. Society should change their views, get thinking, you know? They should move ahead.
Absolutely, Sally, and thanks for that. But Michael, I have to admit, I wasn't totally sure by the end of the book if you would agree with Sally or if you were thinking, well, okay, but really men should just be making rockets and leave the babies at home.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that. I have two. My relationship with my own children is now too rich and interesting. So I don't think that. It wasn't exactly shame that I felt.
Well, there was a surrendered village.
It was a surrender. There was a surrendered village.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was much more. It was much more. When I'm writing that passage, I'm much more thinking, if you just looked at this as a deal, that I'm doing everything my father did. I'm the sole provider for my family, and yet I have all these additional responsibilities, and no one loves me more for it. Why is that? It was just looked at as a deal. I don't think anybody could say that seemed on the surface like a better deal. Now, way down the road, which I didn't appreciate at the time, there's no question you get something back from having taken care of the child very early on. But I did not feel that way at the time. I think your caller is right, though. This is just generally that there probably is a slice of our society that experiences that thinks of this as unmanly. I wasn't really that isn't exactly what I was thinking. I wasn't thinking this is unmanning me. I was more thinking, God, this is just hard. It's just so much more than I can do. Or felt that way at the time.
Yeah, clearly, you write the American deal, or you wrote this earlier, the American deal, or at any rate, the American deal currently fashionable in that's your socioeconomic bracket, is that unless you can prove you are out making money, you had better at least pretend to be home caring for your child.
Yes, there's no question. I can tell you, my wife should be here to defend herself, I think, but explicate me. Yeah. But I can remember after 6 weeks into having our first child, and the baby was colicky, and we hadn't slept. And sleep deprivation, by the way, is a central feature of new parenthood,
yes.
and it's unbelievably grueling. So 6 weeks after that this had happened, I sneaked off. This was really inadvisable. I sneaked off for 2 hours to the gym. And I came home to a scene where my wife was glaring at me and our daughter was screaming at the top of her lungs.
Yeah.
And I looked at her and she said, don't worry, I didn't experience a moment of joy while I was away.
Lucky for you. Of course, you were lying. You spent a little time with the first child, Quinn Tallulah Lewis, in Paris, in France. And you say that the French male has cut an even harsher deal with his spouse than the American one has. What do you mean?
Well, it was just striking to me when I was going off and doing this American dad-like stuff, taking her to gymboree and taking her to swim lessons and all that, the many things I did with her, that it was always me and a whole bunch of French women and their babies. And there was never a French male in sight. So I just that in certainly in Berkeley, but in America generally, when you go and do the things that mothers typically did, you always find a smattering of fathers. When you volunteer at school or whatever the activity is, you find that there's one or two fathers who are doing it along with you. I never found that in Paris. It was much more. The gender roles were much clearer, and the attitude that I got from the women was, you know, they were a little first kind of shocked I was there,
right?
And then just it's funny when you become the honorary mom for a bit,
mm-hmm.
They love you for it. Of course, they want to know what did your wife do to you to get you to do this, so they can go do it.
How
to their
can
husbands.
I do that with my impossible French husband? Who won't even
but
pretend.
That's exactly right. And then their impossible French husbands hate you for infiltrating their world and sowing this idea into it.
Let's go to David in Marlboro, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Lewis.
Hi.
I'd just like to start by congratulating you on putting down all your thoughts on paper, but I consider it a brave and foolish act myself. I've been a stay-at-home dad for the last 12 years. Many times people have said, please write a book, and I said, I'd rather walk in traffic.
Because, what, you're afraid to tell it? What, you? Why, David?
Well, I've worked so hard. I don't want to compare myself to a minority, but it took me so long to gain acceptance, and I always felt like I had to work harder at doing the normal things. I had to have an extra sweater, and you had to have extra food, because you were always fighting for acceptance. And I totally believe full immersion is the only way to go here.
An extra sweater and food? What kind of parenting was this? Sherpa mountain climb? I mean, what do you mean exactly?
Oh, no, whatever the simple act was. If you took the kids to the park, okay.
You were presumed to be incompetent. Right,
be
that's
prepared.
Right.
Totally, even though you were totally competent.
Well, you know, this is very funny that you're saying this, because he sounded like he did the bulk of the parental care. He acquired competence.
Mm-hmm.
Now the problem is when you do 31.5% of it, as I do, you never become the expert. You always know less, and so you're always feeling a little like you don't know what you're doing. And often you're right to think that way. I mean, can we take a simple example?
Yes,
the poo
please.
Diaper.
Yeah.
The poo diaper. All right. This is central. Right. This is a very important thing.
Yes. And the heart of the matter.
The simple poo diaper is not a problem. I was able to handle that easily.
What about the explosive version?
No. By the way, but this is here's where it gets interesting. This is only from a year ago.
Okay.
I had my one-year-old, the swim poo diaper is the interesting one, all right? So I had the swim diaper, you know, pulls up just like underpants, right?
Yes.
I had my one-year-old in the pool, and I was thinking, and I realized that every time I'm with my children, little children in the pool with diapers, I'm tense. Why am I tense? Because I'm worried they're going to poo in their diaper, and I imagine that thing, what is it going to go on when I try to pull that off? Well, sure enough. For the first time in 7.5 years, it happens. We're in a hotel.
Yeah.
I run back to the hotel with him. You know, it's like there might as well have been sirens in the air. I prepare the room. I get all the hotel towels. I lay them out. I lay him down. He's laughing and kicking. I go and I yank off the swim diaper the way it goes on, and the poo shrapnel flies everywhere, and it's just and it's all over me, and it's horrible. He's laughing. In walks my wife, and she says, "What are you doing?" And I said, you know, it finally happened. The swim diaper has poo in it. And she says, no, you don't understand. It comes off. You just rip the little sides. You can rip it off just like
you
and
dork.
I said, really? So I've been worrying about this for 7.5 years. And you know how you tell me?
Yeah.
And she says, what did you think? You just been lucky for 7.5 years? And I said, yes. This kind of problem, and I realize it's an intellectual problem. I realize it's a weakness in me to sort of see that there's some convenient solution to a problem or simple solution to a problem that I imagine to be so complex in dealing with little babies. But it caused enormous stress.
Michael Lewis's new book is Home Game. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Boy, I've been there fishing those rabbit pellets out of the hotel pool while the people swam laps right next. Anna in North Bennington, Vermont. You're on the air, Anna.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make the point that the model, I think, that both the woman and the man are under right now is the co-parenting model. Mm-hmm. And that co-parenting model is no more easier for the woman than it is for the man. When I had my first child, I was 32. I had not changed a diaper. And it was no more easier for me to deal with the crisis of the first 5 months than I think it was for my husband. It was just horrible and difficult. Experience, yes, helps if the woman spends more time. But in this day and age, that's not often the case. And in fact, I was working full time when we had my first child, our first child.
That's interesting. So you're saying, in a way, get over it, Michael. It's not simple. It doesn't, not like it's natural for the mom either.
It's not natural. It's just because it's biologically destined that we give birth to children does not mean that we also have the skills that automatically appear when we give birth to that child. We have to learn how to breastfeed if we choose to do that. We have to learn how to do all those, all the examples that Michael's been giving are examples that his wife probably could say that she had to learn that the poo diaper also unsnapped.
Pull
on
up
the
your
side,
socks,
you know?
Michael. She had to learn too. What's the problem, you whinger?
I didn't say that it wasn't hard for women. It's much harder, in fact. You know, one of the things that was striking to both my wife and I is how dramatically she was affected by childbirth, just her personality. That we had these horrible things would happen after each child was born to her chemicals, and it would go on for months. And we had absolutely no preparation for it. I thought it was harder for men. It was that there was not a body of knowledge that was being passed to me from a previous generation that I could grab onto. It was my wife did have a body of knowledge that was being passed to her.
Interesting. Anna, thank you very much for your call. Michael Lewis's new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. Listeners, you can join us 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for institutions and individuals with a sustained commitment to giving back to the community. More at loomissayles.com. And Charles River Apparel, outerwear for athletic events, corporate gifts, and uniforms. Charles River Apparel, the outerwear company. CharlesRiverApparel.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR. Coming up at noontime today on Here and Now, the World Health Organization has declared a swine flu pandemic. We'll have that story and more on Here and Now, which begins at noon here on WBUR. A reminder that you can have a concise, informative summary of the day's local, national, and international stories from the WBUR newsroom, NPR, and the BBC sent daily to your email and now on WBUR's Facebook page. To sign up, go to WBUR.org and click on WBUR today. Forecast says clouds drizzle today. Highs around 60. Showers tonight with lows in the 50s. Thunderstorms tomorrow. Temperatures in the 70s. And looks like a few clouds Saturday, but sunshine on Sunday.
WBUR supporters include the Worcester Art Museum, where 50 centuries of art and ideas await you from ancient civilizations to present day. WorcesterArt.org, where art celebrates life. And Jean Brooks Landscapes, now with Nest, a new Cambridge store featuring goods inspired by nature for your home, your garden, and yourself. JeanBrooksLandscapes.com.
A scandal a couple of years ago changed the way we do modern market research, but money from the resulting settlement is running out.
Right now, they're under a lot of pressure, and we're seeing a lot of coverage decline as a result. And, you know, who does that hurt? Well, that hurts the guys who can't afford any other kind of research, retail investors.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, running on empty next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
Tonight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered, on WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling author Michael Lewis about being a father when he says the role itself is up for grabs. He's written Liar's Poker, Moneyball, Coach, The Blind Side. His new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. You can join the conversation. Well, dads, do you know what you're supposed to do now as father? And ladies, how does Michael Lewis sound as a dad by your standards? What's the ideal dad? Will we ever get there? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Michael, I wonder if you'd read a little more for us. You write at one point in the book that maternal love may be instinctive, but paternal love is learned behavior. And there's a bit where you describe trying to understand that process of moving from what you felt as indifference to unconditional love for your children.
Yes. The thing that most surprised me about fatherhood the first time around was how long it took before I felt about my child what I was expected to feel. Clutching Quinn after she exited the womb, I was able to generate tenderness and a bit of theoretical affection. But after that, for a good 6 weeks, the best I could manage was detached amusement. The worst was hatred. I distinctly remember standing on a balcony with Quinn squawking in my arms and wondering what I would do if it wasn't against the law to hurl her off it. I also recall convincing myself that official statistics dramatically overstated the incidence of sudden infant death syndrome when an infant dies for no apparent reason in her crib, because most of them were probably murder. The reason we all must be so appalled by parents who murder their infants is that it is so easy and even natural to do. Maternal love may be instinctive, but paternal love is learned behavior. Here is the central mystery of fatherhood, or at any rate, my experience of it. How does a man's resentment of this thing that lands in his lap, in his life, and instantly disrupts every aspect of it for the apparent worse, turn into love? A month after Quinn was born, I would have felt only an obligatory sadness if she'd been rolled over by a truck. 6 months or so later, I'd have thrown myself in front of the truck to save her from harm. What happened? What transformed me from a monster into a father? I do not know, but this time around, I'm keeping a closer eye on the process.
Michael Lewis, reading from Home Game. Quinn was number one, Dixie daughter number two, then Walker. Did that getting attached process get easier, quicker?
Yes, because you know what? I realized it got easier in this sense. It didn't come any more naturally. But I realized it was okay that I didn't feel very much in the beginning because the feelings would come. And so the anxiety around the process diminished dramatically. This role, it's interesting. When you talk about being a father publicly like this, you invite people to evaluate your job.
Oh, yeah.
Bring to the surface with this is just how much social pressure there is to be a certain kind of way, to be a good dad.
Mm-hmm.
But when you don't know what it means to be a good dad, you double the problem. And I realized by the third one that even though I didn't feel very much in the beginning, I would evolve into a good dad and just let the process take its course.
I came away wondering if you felt that, you know, you described earlier that maybe we're in a dark ages now, and you sort of half facetiously say on the way to some ideal state. But I wondered if this halfway house is perpetual here. I mean, do you really think gender roles, you know, that have so consciously tried to re-engineer a bit in recent decades, that they're evolving towards something better in a fundamental way? Or is this a perpetual problem that you described?
Oh, I don't think we're actually going to end up with another standard. I think that once you chuck the standard, you're left with no standard. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's a confusing thing. And from the male's point of view, a largely undescribed thing. I mean, one of the things that one of your earlier callers got at was that, you know, women have to learn all this too, and it's horrible for women too. And I agree. But there's a vast literature about how horrible it is for women. I mean, that there are endless memoirs about how difficult this process was for the mother. And the on the father's side of things, there's largely silence. And there are technical books that are like How to Build a Rocket Ship book.
Right.
And they are somewhat useful, but only somewhat, I found. But there's very little in the way of charting the emotional journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting.
It is. I mean, what? Because men aren't, even though they're expected to do it and have it now, they're not expected to think about it or ponder it. I don't know.
Well, I think men live in fear of the men I know. When I write these things, their first reaction was your first callers. got, you know, a brave and foolish thing you've done.
Yes.
That you're inviting essentially first the outrage of your spouse. And I'm very fortunate. My wife just puts up with me telling her what's on my mind. But you're also inviting social outrage.
Opprobrium.
Yes, you're inviting ostracism. So because it is such a sensitive subject.
Let's go to Sewanee, Tennessee, and Walter. Walter, you're on the air with Michael Lewis.
Thank you. My sons are now 14 and 19, and in fact, related to your first hour, we spent 3 years in South Africa, which was great for them. But when my oldest son was one, and he's now just finished his freshman year at Brown, but I had to go shopping for men's clothing, and it was a Saturday, and I said, I need to go shopping. My wife was really upset, you know, stressed out.
Uh-huh.
Said, well, you're going to have to take the boy with you. So I took him to this, I can't say the name, obviously, but it's a very exclusive men's store in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
I had my, you know, diaper bag and all of that stuff, and, of course, he has an accident in the store, and I had to take him to the fitting room area and plopped out all the paraphernalia and laid it down. He was crying, of course, too. And he knew I was embarrassed and stressed out. And all the feelings Michael, you know, I think was having, I always wanted to be the cool dad, so I always tried to have this veneer of being cool.
But this all sounds very familiar. Okay, so?
And I'm doing this, and like, you know, people are looking at me and wondering how I've invaded their sanctum with this, you know, child and diapers and all of this.
Yeah.
One mother who was shopping for her son was very impressed that I was doing this, said, your wife must be very grateful to you for this. And all I would just say is that, you know, there aren't a lot of books about this. I remember a little funny book called Daddy Cool that came out about 20 years ago when my first son was born. But I just think that The rule book in this postmodern age is to be present. If you can be present, all the rest of the stuff you'll just learn. It's, you know, it's just sort of like learning to ride a bike or something. You just do it, and it will work out. So thank you, Michael. I've enjoyed your other books, and keep up the good work.
Hey, oh, well, thank you.
That's good. You sound like Daddy Cool to me, Walter. What do you say, Michael?
I think he's right. I mean, I think showing up is a huge part of the job. It's a huge part of any job. It's certainly a huge part of this job. I've found that the kind of when I think about what the rule book is, in the early stage, showing up is the big part. I agree. That after that, the sort of two things that I try to keep in my mind as I raise my children is number one. If you want to change your children, change yourself. That it is amazing how they just model you, and how little effect you have when you're just trying to, when you're just talking at them. And but the second thing is that in order to sort of develop a real relationship with them, it's amazing how valuable it is, and this sounds so simple, but I think it's true, how valuable it is to like them, that to develop not just love, but like them, and that they how much they pick this up. Mm-hmm. And both these, especially the second point, it really does come in part from being around. There's no question, you develop the relationship just by being there. And paying attention.
And that visceral connection that you're going to love and they're going to love. Lonnie in New Haven, Connecticut. You're on with Michael Lewis.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm a new mom, 8 months old, and I also work full-time, and so that's been quite a challenge. And currently my husband's deployed overseas, but he's returning soon.
Oh,
but before he left, you know, we were both tending to all the new babies' needs as best we both could, and it's just, for both of us, very difficult and demanding. So I think that, you know, the co-parenting model that one of the previous speakers mentioned is burdensome on both, and I think from the woman's perspective, I'm glad that my husband's gotten to experience some of the difficulties, because it's so physically and mentally demanding and draining, and it's just makes life easier for someone else to kind of be suffering along with you.
Absolutely.
They also appreciate you more.
Yes. Right. But it's also, you know, as many women and men both work, and so I think it's especially helpful for the husband if both parents work to pitch in also, just so that, you know, the woman, or in my case, you know, you don't feel like you go to work all day and then come home and start your second job with no relief whatsoever. And then, you know, sure. where the husband gets to enjoy just a few moments of fun and then hand the baby back over. But
Lonnie, how do you even do it with your husband deployed abroad? I don't know if Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever it may be. How on earth do you even do it with an 8-month-old?
Well, this has been tricky, but, you know, with a combination of some help from family and childcare during the day, but it's a full-time job for anyone, and it's definitely difficult for both parents to deal with.
No kidding. Lonnie, thank you very much for calling, and good luck. I hope your husband's home and helping out real, real soon and home safe. Let's get a call from Boston, Scotland. Scotland, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Very well.
Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I raised three boys from middle school through high school, and it was a real challenge. But one of the things that I think your guest has overlooked in terms of the bond that forms and that visceral kind of feeling, what changes, you know, what prevents a child, a parent from wanting to toss the child under the truck or what have you.
Mm.
And what I discovered is that it's the unconditional love that you get from your children growing up. It's that smile when you're sitting down and they do something that they've never done before, the way they look at you when you're someplace, or you may be walking down the beach and they grab your hand. I remember one instance with my son where I was taking him out to Cape Cod, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, a late drive out there, and he just turned his head to me and he said, "I love you, Dad." And I didn't hear him the first time. And he said, I said, "What?" He said, "I love you, Dad." And it just came out of the blue. And it's things like that that transform how you feel as a parent from the male perspective, that really kind of consecrates that bond between the parent and the child, or I should say father and son or father and daughter.
Mm. Scotland, you make it very real. And thanks for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael, the unconditional love coming back from the child, that's pretty powerful glue.
Yes, but you notice that the child had to express that love. In other words, the child was talking. So we're talking about, you know, 2 years into the process. So yes, I agree. It's unbelievably powerful. But you feel the feelings that the transformation I was describing happens before the child has any real ability to express that love.
Yeah.
And that was what was curious to me. There's no question that further on, when you have all this love coming back at you, especially in verbal form, absolutely, it's a very powerful glue.
Nash in Glover, Vermont, you're on the air with Michael Lewis. Nash.
Hi, Tom and Michael. I want to thank you first both for the good humor you're injecting into this important conversation.
How else?
I would like to make two very quick points.
Yeah.
One is the poop stories really take me way back. And they're wonderful. And I have to say that I really dreaded the thought of becoming a diaper changer. But when it finally arrived, I discovered that it was a really special time with the kids. And it was a time for us to talk with each other.
I hope you're not still doing it.
Them. We were face to face. It turned out to be quite terrific. And I have to say now that I sort of miss it in a way. And the other point is this. You're reminding me of an old movie, a Sidney Poitier movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Okay.
And as I remember it, and I hope I have this right, there's a scene where Sidney Poitier's father is really tearing into him for disgracing the family because he's taking up with a white woman. And Sidney Poitier says, the father says, "You owe us not to put us into this terrible bind." And Sidney Poitier responds to his father, "Dad, I didn't choose to come into this world. You brought me here. You owe me everything." And that's been kind of my philosophy right along, that when we bring kids into the world, we owe them everything, and we have to do our best as in a partnership or single parenting, that whatever it takes, they deserve it.
Hey, Nash, that's great. A package deal, no question about it. Michael Lewis, our time grows short. I wonder, there you've got Quinn, daughter one, Dixie, daughter two, and Walker, your son. We began the hour talking a little bit about your father, what kind of father he was, what he sort of gave you as a model. What do you think you're going to give Walker, either explicitly or implicitly?
As a role model, as a father, when it comes time for him to be a father, I'm sure he'll regard me as a Neanderthal. I'm sure he will say, you poor bastard. It's amazing how little you knew and how unevolved you were. But so I'll give him that. I'll give him confidence because he can't help but think he'll do better.
Oh, that's pretty good. There it is. The new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. Michael Lewis, we're glad you made those notes. It turns out to be a good story for all of us to be aware of, and we appreciate your sharing it with us today. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, happy Father's Day when it gets here.
Oh, appreciate it. Send me a present.
maybe. Thank you very much. Michael Lewis's new book is Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale-Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Sara Abdulrahman, Molly Connors, and Abby Ruzica. Our senior producer is Gwen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.